There's only one candidate in this 2024 race who has called Donald Trump America's Hitler, and it's not Joe Biden, and it is not Kamala Harris. It is his own nominee. What does that tell you? You could not script this. You could not make this up.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by two of our regulars, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Bill Galston is on a reporting trip this week, so we are happy to have my Bulwark colleague, Andrew Egger, sit in. And we are delighted to welcome a first-time guest, New Yorker writer Susan Glasser. She is joining us from Milwaukee, where she is covering the Republican convention. You can read her, as I say, in The New Yorker. Also, her most recent book, written with her husband, Peter Baker, is The Divider, which was a best-selling history of the Trump administration. So welcome, one and all. I'd like to begin, and by the way, I apologize for my scratchy throat. I have a little virus. So let's begin with the response to the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Obviously, you know, all people of goodwill are relieved and happy that it was unsuccessful by a hair. And so that goes without saying. But there has been an attempt since this shooting to delegitimize any criticism of Trump as inciting violence. So you had, for example, Representative Corey Mills, who said, the bottom line is this. First, they tried to censor and silence President Trump. Then they tried to indict and imprison President Trump. Now they tried to kill President Trump. And somebody on Twitter who has a large following said, after today, I never want to hear January 6th from anyone on the left again. So, Susan Glasser, thank you for joining us. How do you see this attempt to silence criticism and also the sort of normalizing of Trump that has happened since then, sort of trying to fold him into the normal fold of American politics when in fact he is an enemy of all of those norms? Does one's bullet make him legit?
Look, it's very interesting to be having this conversation. We're just a few days away from a very shocking and, you know, kind of traumatic event in the life of any country. And I think that what was interesting to me was because people have such well-defined views about Donald Trump, I think that news cycle is going to last a lot less long than it might have at a different moment in our country. And this is not necessarily a positive thing, by the way. I mean, it speaks to a yawning divide. And I don't imagine that there are really any people who disliked Donald Trump before who are going to vote for him as a result of this horrific act. You're right that there was a strong effort among supporters of Trump to immediately make sweeping claims about this. Here at the Republican convention so far, we've heard awful lot of, you know, God Almighty himself saved our leader kind of stuff. You know, basically a convention that was already going to be about the persecution of Donald Trump, the martyrdom of Donald Trump. Before that was at the hands of the evil deep state. It was at the hands of the evil Justice Department. Now it's, you know, even more literally, you know, that he dodge this bullet because God wants him to be our next president. You know, that kind of rhetoric, I don't think really has a major effect on the presidential race. So I think this will be less of a political event than it might have been at a different moment. However, I will tell you the mood here, the vibe is we're going to win this thing. We've got this thing won. And that has turned, oddly, the scrutiny really right back to the Democrats and Biden in a way that I've never been at a convention where that's been the case. It's really weird. So that's my on the ground report.
Yeah, that's interesting. So Andrew Egger, it always sort of amuses me when people say God decreed that this bullet only graze his ear and not enter his skull. Do they also think that God, like, let the shooter get up onto the roof, and God decided, you know, that Trump needed a haircut? I mean, the whole thing is so preposterous. I don't know, but leave that aside. This has definitely sort of strengthened the sort of martyrdom and worship of Trump that was already present in the GOP in spades. So this only doubles that. But does it? I mean, so Susan Glasser makes the point that not really clear that this is going to change anybody else's views on this. I'm inclined to agree with that. What do you think?
Yeah, on the kind of messianic stuff, it's particularly odd, just given that somebody did die. I mean, that, you know, yeah, God sort of steered the bullets clear of Donald Trump, but what's the kind of the consequence of that line of thinking, as far as, you know, this man who jumped on his own kids and protected them and then was shot as a result of that? So it's a little difficult to go there. Specifically on the question of kind of how other people are going to kind of need to parse this, it's been interesting to see specifically how President Biden and his White House and his campaign have kind of tried to thread this needle. You saw Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre come out yesterday and led off her press briefing with some words about lowering the temperature, about, you know, focusing on the things that unite us as opposed to the things that divide us, and that being something that needs to happen kind of across the political spectrum. But at the same time, we're right in the middle of this existential campaign season. About an hour after that, the Biden campaign held a press call reacting to the selection of Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as Trump's vice presidential pick, where they leaned into all of the things that they say makes him a dangerous candidate in terms of, you know, his embrace of Trump's attacks on norms and his explicit you know, endorsement of Trump's attempts to steal the election in 2020. And so, you know, it's sort of a difficult balance to strike, because what you're trying to lower the temperature on the one hand, and on the other hand, as the president himself said yesterday, you're going to speak the truth. You're going to continue to prosecute this case. And so, you know, whether it's possible to kind of like do that better or worse, kind of remains to be seen. They are trying to be a little bit more careful, and it's just something that they're going to need to kind of weigh in as they're going forward.
Linda, this sort of instinctive or reflexive reaction to say we need to lower the temperature, you know, it's, first of all, it implies that this is sort of, that there's an equivalent amount of hysteria on both sides, which I don't think is true, not remotely. It doesn't account for all the ways in which Trump himself has, you know, justified and incited violence. But the other part of it is the truth. We are facing an existential moment. Trump really is a threat to democracy. And so, really, isn't, I think, all of this tendency, even on the part of Biden and his people, to say, yes, you know, we need to lower the temperature, is actually misplaced. What do you think?
Absolutely. Mona, look, there's no question that the rhetoric has gotten very ugly in recent years. But there is one person you can point to who I believe is responsible for that. It doesn't mean that others haven't gotten involved, that they haven't weighed into, but it started in 2015 with Donald Trump. And he has continued to do it at each and every time he's had an opportunity to stand before a microphone, at all of his rallies. The demonization that takes place. He, you know, has said very, very much that he wants retribution, that he does intend to pursue people who have been his political opponents, that he made a mistake not going after Hillary Clinton and putting her in jail the last time. But when he, you know, talks about poisoning the blood of the people, when he talks about vermin, when he says all of these things, and even, you know, encouraging rally goers to be physically violent, as he did in 2016, not to mention, and I will mention, January 6th. So, you know, there is a double standard here. And I don't think that he should get a free pass because some nutcase took to the roof. I think we ought to have a very serious discussion. I'm sure you're going to probably go there next about the serious security failures and how this was allowed to happen. But that's not the same thing as saying that somehow this is a Democratic plot or that any of us who have talked about the threats to the Republican and the way in which our norms, our societal norms, have changed, the demoralization of American politics that has done taken place in the Trump era. All of that, I think we have to continue talking about.
Damon, Joe Biden himself, a few years back, in a speech to a black audience, said that Republicans want to put y'all back in chains. I remember that one. There are plenty of examples of people going over the top in their rhetoric. But there's never been a figure in American life like Donald Trump before, who has a huge national following, who basically controls one party, not basically, who controls one of our parties, and who attempted a violent coup. I mean, so that's just reality. And so anyway, your comments.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting conversation and it's worth having, but I do think it's important to keep in mind that it's all happening because the reaction of the right to the news of the attempted assassination was almost immediately to say, this is on Democrats, this is on the left. As if, and on a few times this week, I've made this connection because I do think it's interesting that the current issue of the New Republic has this, I think, very over the top cover where there's a photograph of Donald Trump made to look like Adolf Hitler. And underneath it in the old Prussian Gothic script, it says American fascism under it. You know, I've been engaged in the kind of fascism debate for years now, and I think that there are good arguments on both sides, and I think it's a totally legitimate thing to debate. But a cover like that is clearly a clickbaity kind of cover. It's as if the right, in response to the assassination, immediately went to like the assumption that the guy who tried to kill Trump was some leftist Antifa guy who like had a subscription to the New Republic, and they're going to find a copy of that issue in his apartment with an agonized screed in which he says, I want to be a law-abiding American, but the media keeps telling me this guy is Hitler. And if I could have killed baby Hitler, I would have done it. And so I got to kill this guy today. That's all totally a fantasy, totally projection, totally a confession of a desire, a fantasy of certain people on the right to believe that they are in a situation where half the country wants to murder the candidate I love. And it is not true. The guy we now know was a registered Republican. Like almost every young man who tries to shoot a politician or who just shoots up a crowd, which we have a very unfortunate epidemic of in this country, he's just a very troubled sort of sociopath who has major problems and really wasn't motivated by any coherent rationale at all. And rather than just let it be and let the investigation go underway, we, of course, had a very 2024 social media frenzy that very night where the right jumped to these conclusions. And the result is the Biden campaign stepped back and we're like, whoa, we're going to stop. We're not going to say these things. They were very cautious. People took the claim seriously. And, you know, I don't think it should be taken seriously, even if it were true that the guy was on the left and was motivated by something he read. Most Americans, the overwhelming majority of Americans, nearly everybody will not just go out and try to shoot a presidential candidate because of things that we're saying about that person in our discourse. That is part of what it means to have a free society. And you can't shut that down and insulate Trump because some psychopath tried to kill him. So the whole argument for me is kind of an exercise in the worst bad faith, in my view.
And that brings us directly to our new nominee as vice president, J.D. Vance, who was one of those people, Damon, who immediately after the attempted assassination jumped onto Twitter to say this: "Today is not just some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs. That rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination." Let me just say, unquote, let me just say, just of course, the idea that, you know, fascist who must be stopped at all costs, what Trump's opponents, you know, except for the stray crazy person out there, are trying to do is defeat him at the ballot box. Okay, that's pretty obvious. But let's talk about Mr. Vance. I said on another podcast that I did this week that he hoodwinked me back in 2016 when he wrote that book. I had him on my podcast then and reviewed the book very favorably, and I had some conversations with him. Believed that he was a rising, interesting voice on the right. And then, of course, he made his strong heel turn and became as more Trumpy than thou. So the first people for whom this is a disaster are, of course, the brave Ukrainians. This represents a true setback for them. But let's talk a little bit about what this says about Trump's vision for the future. Susan, would you say that he is thinking about his legacy and extending Trumpism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And I would also not only agree with Damon's point about the immediate effort to silence dissent, but let's recall that if it's overheated for the New Republic to put a cover talking about American fascism, there's only one candidate in this 2024 race who has called Donald Trump America's Hitler. And it's not Joe Biden, and it is not Kamala Harris. It is his own nominee. What does that tell you? You could not script this. You could not make this up. It's so remarkable. It's not just that, like Marco Rubio or Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis, that J.D. Vance was a critic of Donald Trump's before he was a supporter. He literally called his running mate America's Hitler, and Donald Trump still picked him number one. So I think that is probably the most remarkable thing to know. And what I observed to your first question of this conversation today, Mona, was that the end of the kind of, oh my gosh, this is so terrible, we must come together as a country, national unity news cycle, the moment that it really ended was very soon afterwards. On Monday, when Donald Trump picked J.D. Vance. And that's when I noticed the sort of air going out of the sails of this anxiety among Democrats that we can't be critical of Trump. Because Trump, in choosing Vance, I think he went in the direction of kind of maximal confrontation, division, controversy. He certainly made a statement about what he sees as the future direction of a Trumpist party. You don't pick a guy who's literally 40 years younger than you with almost no experience unless that's a statement that you want to make about the future and about youth. So I think it is very significant. It also tells you who is Trump listening to right now. And having written our book, on Trump in the White House, I think it's very important for people to understand that he is unusually manipulable for a public official because of his, you know, real focus essentially on the media, on public presentation. He's not a policy guy. There are certainly, you know, some strong preconceived notions that Trump has. But outside of that, it really matters who is talking to him, who's in his ear, and who the top staff are. So I think it's a significant statement about what kind of an administration he wants to run, and also who he's listening to right now, which is to say, you know, the apparent ascendance of his son Don Jr. and Tucker Carlson was not an accident. Again, then when Trump showed up on Monday night at the convention to greet his nominee, the very first person who he greeted in his box was not J.D. Vance, it was actually Tucker Carlson. I think that, you know, Elon Musk also advocating for Vance, very interesting, announcing this enormous financial commitment. Trump is a very transactional figure. These folks think they're buying something. So the question is, what is it that they're buying? And then just my final point about Vance and the politics of it is that it is also a statement of a very confident Trump and a confident campaign. And yeah, if he felt the need to, you know, go more to the center, that would have told us something. He did not feel that need. And yeah, I'm amazed at how gentle the coverage is, though. Even with all of that, this is a 39-year-old first-term senator who has shown us that he has no fixed principles or strong convictions because he's willing to change them. And he would be, if Donald Trump, a very overweight 78-year-old man, were to become president, there is an incredibly high chance that this guy could become president. And I haven't heard that be really a theme of the coverage so far this week.
Yeah, those are really, really good points. So I did see a cartoon that circulated this week on Twitter that showed Vance saying to Trump, "Sorry about calling you Hitler." Then the next frame was, "Glad you viewed it as a compliment." So Andrew, let me just give you another quote from Vance to give a flavor of the kind of person who, as Susan was just outlining, stands, if Trump wins in November, stands a very good chance of becoming president of the United States at an unbelievably young age, with very little experience. He said that Trump should fire every single mid-level bureaucrat in the U.S. government and replace them with our people. All right, that's bad, but it's not. This is the part that I want to underline. And if the courts object, he said, you stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it. So, by the way, that's an apocryphal quote from Jackson, didn't say it, but never mind. The point is that J.D. Vance does not believe in law. He believes in authoritarian power.
Yeah, and I think to the extent that he believes in anything, right? To kind of take Susan's point a little further. This really is a guy who his genius, insofar as he's demonstrated any so far, has been in always kind of skating to where the puck is going, right? Perceiving the next rung on the ladder and getting there. And that's not a virtue. But it's a trait that's shared by a lot of politicians. He's shown an unusual aptitude for it. And it's the sort of thing that is particularly dangerous at this moment where all of the incentives are so horrible. Because of Trump's sort of unique and unprecedented ownership of the party, where the whole vice presidential kind of public audition process was all of these guys going on TV and going on these podcasts and giving statements to the press, where they were kind of all falling over themselves to be the least Mike Pence-y of them, because that was the big lesson that Trump took away from his last vice president, which is the one time that Mike Pence had to kind of make a decision about following the law or doing something that Donald Trump really, really wanted him to do, he followed the law. He followed the Constitution, and you know, that has loomed large in Trump's mind throughout this whole process. And so Vance's the thing that has put him head and shoulders, even over guys like Marco Rubio or Doug Burgum, who were also saying things, you know, not quite on that level, but saying, no, please put me in. I definitely wouldn't do what Mike Pence did, Mr. Trump. I'd be there for you. But he's very smart. He's very bright and well-spoken, and he can really turn a phrase. So even among the whole crowd of Republican officials, taking pains to show themselves to be as pliable as possible, he really did stand out, and it will be interesting to see how that plays out if he does get the shot at being our actual vice president in a couple of months here.
Yeah, Linda, you know, Trump famously likes killers, and Vance has portrayed himself that way, and he. You know, whereas it's interesting because the choice of Pence in 2016 was to placate the evangelicals, and he felt that he had to appeal to them with that offer. Now they are so bought in. I mean, they worship Trump now, not Jesus. So he didn't have to worry about that. And so he just to underline what Andrew said, that he wanted to make sure that he had somebody who would have no respect for law. You couldn't really say that with confidence about Burgum or Rubio. They might perhaps still have a tiny flicker of conscience or principle, maybe. I mean, it's a long shot, but it's still, right? With Vance, you're sure. You're right. Sure. This guy...
Right. No, I mean, you know, I am no longer enamored of Marco Rubio as I once was, but, you know, Rubio wouldn't sell out Ukraine. He wouldn't be quick to do that.
Right.
This guy has absolutely no core. I think what this represents, though, Mona, is something that people like you and I have to come to terms with. And that is that there is no longer a Republican Party that we can never return to, that there's no hope that out of the ashes we will get some sort of reform. I mean, look at the people who are not at that convention. It's being held in Wisconsin. Paul Ryan, who is the Speaker of the House and who passed the tax cut bill that Trump likes to take credit for. That wasn't Trump. That was Paul Ryan. He had that bill waiting in the wings for a long time before. But he's not there. He can't, you know, cross the street to go to the convention. Obviously, somebody like Liz Cheney's not there. Mitt Romney's not there. I mean, I could keep going on the list of the people who weren't there. This represents what we've been told was happening. And I, for one, eternal, you know, naive optimist that I sometimes am, kept thinking, well, at some point, the conservative movement will realize this is not conservatism. This is populism, which is very different and very dangerous. But I think what this shows is that there is no conservative party in America anymore. There is now only a cultish populist party that has absolutely no principle. And by the way, as you've suggested, is definitely not the party of law and order and constitutionalism.
Damon, you can comment on anything you've heard, but I wonder if you would say a few words about what this means just in terms of foreign policy. I mean, I don't like the fact that these people are often referred to as isolationists because they're really not. They're Putin pals. Tucker Carlson is literally in the employ of RT now. And he has been the greatest apologist for Putin, the most prominent, shall we say. Vance is a fan of Orban, another Putin pal. So that's the direction this Republican Party is going, not just isolationism, but joining the jackals.
Yeah, to quote a headline of of a piece you wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated story, I think, in some respects, because I've written this week about how, along the lines of what Linda was saying, that like there has been some uncertainty about what the future will hold. We've had these debates now for years. What's the post-Trump Republican Party going to be? Is it going to sort of loop back around to some modified version of Reaganism? Or is it just onward forever into deeper right-wing populism in the direction of Orbanist, elective authoritarianism, basically, or something even worse, perhaps. And this selection, though I don't think Trump made it for this reason, I think he made this selection partly on a whim, partly because his sons prevailed on him. There's been some reporting about that. That basically Trump Jr. and Eric were like, you can't pick Burgum. He's boring. You got to go with Vance. And of course, Vance has been the perfect Trump toady. So that ingratiated himself to Trump. So I don't think Trump's thinking in these terms, but I do think that the Vance selection does signal that the person who one would presume would follow Trump if he wins in 4 years, assuming Trump doesn't try to stick around for a third term, bracket that, is an ideologist, is a guy who thinks in terms of systems and constellations of ideas. And part of, and that then signals that, yeah, we're staying Trump. This is going to be Trump, but as an ideology, which Trump is not. He doesn't think in those terms at all. It's all about instinct and impulse. And so that is very significant and very ominous, I think, for the future. And to get to your selected, your choice part of the question about foreign policy, the interesting thing is that Trump still, despite his personal love of Putin, I still don't have any idea what he exactly will do as president, because he could do anything. What if the Saudis back channel a message to him saying, actually, we would like you to double down on Ukraine funding and we'll give you $100 million.
Yeah.
Trump would in a second do it, and he would force Vance to go out and make the case for it.
Yeah.
So Vance's journey is most likely not over yet, because he has to, for at least 4 years, if Trump wins, be the toady. And so that's a real kind of wild card, because Trump is a wild card. And I don't know where it goes. In strictly speaking, if you just took what Vance would prefer to do based on what he's been saying over the last couple of years, he is not, strictly speaking, an isolationist. He is a little bit like what DeSantis was trying to grope toward in the primaries. He's like this guy, Elbridge Colby, who's a kind of China hawk on the right, who will probably have a very nice job in another Trump administration. He served in the last Trump administration in the Pentagon. He makes the case that America is overtaxed. We do not have either the attention or the resources, or, and on this, I think he's right, the manufacturing base to be actively engaged in propping up Ukraine against Russia and being ready for a China attack on Taiwan. Therefore, we have to make the Europeans take up the slack on Ukraine, pull back from that, and put everything, all the chips down on China and Taiwan. That's what Vance is saying he also believes. Is it real? Or would he then, if Trump doesn't do the about face on Ukraine and is willing to say, yeah, let him go, I'll solve it in 24 hours. And what that means is we're going to force Ukraine and Russia to negotiate where Russia gets everything it wants, basically. I think that's the more likely scenario, but who knows? Then the question is, would Trump signal to President Xi that he would come to Taiwan's aid? And I think absolutely not. Trump is the more consistent isolationist, in the sense that he really doesn't want to be involved in anything except a momentary feeling of oh, this situation calls for force, so I'll throw in some troops. But that itself can change like the wind. And so, again, if we're talking Vance for 4 years having to defend Trump saying to Xi, yeah, take Taiwan if you want, I don't care about that, then who knows what he's left with. By then, he will probably have evolved even further to uphold that view rather than the Elbridge Colby kind of, you know, right realist argument of DeSantis. So that's, I guess, where I see it. And I'll stop monologuing at this point.
Thank you for that. All right. We have one more topic I want to cover, but first we're going to hear from Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. So it's self-cooling for better sleep. It's self-cleaning. They have comfort and quality. Miracle sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. They are designed for your skin. Stop sleeping on bacteria. So to try Miracle Made, go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo, BEGTODIFFER, at checkout, you'll also get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. So go to trymiracle.com/BEGTODIFFER. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. While all this is going on, the Democrats are also involved in a crisis. Shortly before we began recording today, Adam Schiff, Representative Adam Schiff from California, who is very close to Nancy Pelosi, came out with a public call for Biden to stand down. This follows, I think, 20 members of the House who've already done the same, which could become, well, we'll see. We're not sure what it's going to become. But Susan, you wrote about Biden's speech this week, or his interview, where he, you know, he was just all of these attempts that he is making, where he says, you know, just watch me. And he goes out and he gives the Stephanopoulos or the Lester Holt interview. It just reinforces what everybody knows, right? And so the question is, does he not know? Is he really that isolated and cut off that he doesn't realize what's going on?
Yeah, I think this is, of course, the fascinating thing. Right now, we're in the middle of the Republican convention, and yet in many ways, the bigger news story right now is on the Democratic side. And there's really only a short window of time here for Democrats who don't want Biden to run again to see if they can make that happen. What I perceive is happening is that it's not as much a question of isolation. I know that's been the kind of reporting theme of the week, and I don't doubt any of those reports. But in my view, it's something actually more problematic for Democrats, which is Biden digging in his heels. And that what we've seen is a president who is increasingly obstinate, cantankerous, self-centered. He has chosen his own political fortunes in many respects at the expense of data, which people in his own party believe increasingly point to the unwinnability of the election. And indeed, their fears now are, you know, around the scale of that defeat. And not even whether it would happen. And so, you know, I just came from an event here at the convention with Trump's pollster, John Fabrizio. And, you know, it was not surprisingly a very confident presentation. And I think the Democrats on the panel, it was moderated by David Axelrod. You know, he's been very outspoken, kind of leading Democrats, saying that Biden needs to slip aside or the party's facing a landslide. That has now become, in my view, almost a mainstream view among Democratic officials, current and former, you know, liberal commentators. And, you know, I don't think the rebellion is over. I think that Schiff is, as you said, not only close to Pelosi, but what I've observed in watching their tag team very closely over the years is that he tends to be socializing where she's going publicly, and that they are in that level of coordination. And it's my view that they have told Biden this privately, and that now if he doesn't act, that they're going to start to speak more publicly, and that that's the final remaining leverage that they have. It might not work, but I think that Biden has just, it's even worse than his inability to prosecute the case against Trump verbally, right? Which we now can see, you know, he can't do that. And he has sort of ceded the function of communicator in chief, number one. But I think it's gone beyond that. And we're now in a situation where Biden is now undercutting the party's best arguments against Trump's return to power. Number one, that Trump is too old, incoherent, you know, out of his mind, losing his abilities. So you can't do that if you're running a guy who's even older and more incoherent. Number one. Number two, Biden was trying to make the argument essentially that Donald Trump is all about himself and we're about the country. Well, how can you do that when he is digging in this way? So, you know, I'll leave it at that. But I do think the next few days are really crucial to see whether they translate this pressure against Biden into actual public statements by leaders, not just by rank and file members or even respected people like Michael Bennett or Adam Schiff, but public statements by leaders. That's going to be something I don't believe that Biden can withstand, because he's lost his own electorate. The people don't want it, no matter how much blue Twitter tries to pretend otherwise. Right. The numbers are overwhelming and clear that Democratic voters do not want him to be their nominee right now, regardless of the outcome of the non-existent primary campaign.
That's right. There was a new poll just out today or yesterday. AP, nearly two-thirds of Democrats want Biden to withdraw. And only 30%, again, of Democrats believe that he has the mental fitness to serve another term. But Andrew, this is, if it were happening to somebody else or if it were a movie, it would be great drama, because the clock is ticking, right? I mean, and the Biden forces are trying to run out the clock. They're trying to get, you know, the nomination done online before the August convention, and the and there was this whole kerfuffle over the Ohio filing deadline, which then was extended. But the fact is, no matter how you slice it, the clock is ticking. And it's anybody, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, yeah. And there was even some question too, because a lot of this sort of, man, Biden really needs to step aside talk from within the institutional larger Democratic apparatus. A lot of that was kind of put temporarily on hold, you know, after understandably so, pushed out of the news cycle by the attempt on former President Trump's life over the weekend. And so kind of coming into this week, there was this question of, okay, has that wave crested and now receded? What's going to happen now? And kind of the first big stress test of that was this reporting about, you know, the DNC attempt to kind of go ahead and get him nominated early on this relatively spurious pretext having to do with Ohio election law. Some people would say quite spurious. Basically saying that because Ohio had this kind of snafu about whether or not they were going to be able to have him on the ballot, that has now been resolved. But we still need to be kind of better safe than sorry and meet their earlier deadline. You can read all about it. We shouldn't get too in the weeds on it here. But basically the party was saying, we got to go ahead and do this kind of just in case. And
yeah,
and kind of dared Biden's critics within the party to have a problem with that. And so transpired that they still did have a problem with that. And kind of over the last couple of days, they kind of called that bluff a little bit. There were a number of House Democrats who were preparing a letter basically to send to the DNC saying, are you insane? Like you cannot possibly think that this maneuver will end well. If our voters feel like you rammed through this this guy who increasingly does look incapable of doing the job when he comes into these public appearances. And they blinked on it at least a little bit. The news this morning is that they're still going to try to do this virtual thing ahead of the convention, but not on such an accelerated timetable as it was seeming prior. And of course, it's still a situation that's very much in flux. All that was even prior to, as we've talked about, Adam Schiff coming out, and you know, this ongoing trickle of new Democrats stepping forward to say that they don't feel that Biden is at least up for the task of winning re-election, although a lot of them are stopping short of saying that they don't feel he's capable of doing the job. But I think it's definitely safe to say that if there was a question of whether kind of the events in Pennsylvania, we're going to push it out of the way, that we now know it remains an ongoing problem for Biden within his own party.
Linda, when members of Congress, like a group of moderate Democrats, had a meeting with Biden about this and very gingerly, you know, were raising the matter with him, he was basically snapping and snarling. Here's what he said to Crow, who is, I forget his first name.
Colorado, Jason.
Jason, Crow. Thank you. Jason Crow, who asked, and he said, you know, he yelled at him. He said, "You saw what happened recently in terms of the meeting we had with NATO. I put NATO together. Name me a foreign leader who thinks I'm not the most effective leader in the world on foreign policy. Tell me who the hell that is. Tell me who put NATO back together, et cetera, et cetera." And he went on this way. Honestly, there's a lot of echo of "I alone can fix it" here.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess maybe in order to be president of the United States, you have to be a narcissist. I don't know. One of the things that we said back in 2020 about Joe Biden was he had the character to be president. Well, he's not demonstrating that character now. I don't know. This may be a crazy suggestion, but I think that those who are really serious about getting a new candidate have got to ignore trying to convince Biden otherwise. I think there's going to have to be a kind of open rebellion at the Democratic convention. Now, whether the rules will allow for that, I guess, you know, we'll find out. But the one person who has the leadership position and the leadership skills to do that, plus the interpersonal skills, is Nancy Pelosi. And at some point, Nancy Pelosi has to put together a plan to replace Joe Biden at the top of the ticket. And it's going to have to take place at the convention, because it does not look like anything is going to convince him. He says, you know, the Lord Almighty is going to have to be the one to step down. Well, I hate to tell you, but the Lord Almighty is giving you lots of signals that maybe it's not a good idea to keep pursuing this, and you're not listening. I don't think that he can be convinced. I think there are people close to him, Jill and Hunter, who are playing a destructive role, and obviously people who want to keep their jobs and want to keep their power, who are in his closest inner circle, may not be helpful either. So this has got to be open rebellion. This has to be a usurping the king.
Okay, well, Susan Glasser had to leave us because she had other responsibilities, but we were delighted to have her on the podcast and hope to have her in the future. So we're going to pick up where we left off, which is that Linda was saying that she wants to see a coup against Biden, orchestrated by Nancy Pelosi, which we all want. Damon, I have to tell you that the people I talk to say Pelosi's all in. But the question is, will there be enough time? Will there be enough will on the part of the whole Democratic caucus? And I guess the other question is, like, is there anything that Biden has demonstrated that he is vain, arrogant, unreachable, really. And so is there anything that people can use to force him out? Like, can they threaten to embarrass him? I mean, what What is left? Because the stakes are rather high.
Yeah, I mean, I at this point, I'm inclined to think that there isn't much that people can hold over him to make him personally do the right thing and realize it's time for him to step down in the race. I mean, for all the reporting I keep seeing indicates a kind of bunker mentality with Biden and his immediate family, his wife, his son, the lovely Hunter, and then other members of the kind of larger group sort of creating a cordon around him, and very few advisors are able to get one-on-one time with him. He is not being shown or asking to see polling data that would back up the assertions that people are making to him, many of them in interviews, where they say, well, these polls are showing that you're way behind in all these swing states and so forth, and they want you to step out. And then he says, I haven't seen that. I don't know anything about that. So I don't know if it'll be possible. And if it is, it's going to be the result of stuff we're never going to know from the outside until long after the fact, because it's going to require the chief of staff, the head of the campaign, to kind of do things behind the scenes in the White House that are pretty dramatic, but are not going to be public knowledge. So what I'm hoping for is something like what Linda was sketching out, that basically every single public event that Biden now has is kind of treated as an occasion to re-adjudicate his fitness, and he is not doing well. He is not doing well in unscripted remarks, obviously, as the debate was. He is not doing well in front of teleprompters. There were clips of this speech at the NAACP on Tuesday circulating where he made very clear he could not consistently read the teleprompter. He came up with one of the worst policy proposals of his entire presidency this week, the idea of capping rents nationally at 5% increase per week, which is, it's like, I think Meghan McCardle had a funny tweet saying, oh, everyone's saying, you know, Trump's idea to throw tariffs on everything is the worst economic idea I've ever heard. And Biden's like, hold my beer. How about national rent control?
Yeah.
So he came out with that, but not only did he do that, which seems desperate and kind of playing to the left, when at this point he should be well into making a pitch for the center, for the general election. Instead, he, at the NAACP, he misreads the teleprompter, says, I'm going to cap rents at $55. So he can't even read the percent sign correctly. And he frequently gets into a point reading it on the teleprompter and then sort of mumbles, stops, and then just says anyway, and then changes to the next thing. And he does this repeatedly. It is completely untenable. We have never, ever seen a general election campaign in the last couple of months where whoever the other side is running, where one side has a candidate who is utterly incapable of making the case for his own record, for why the other person is a bad choice, and just able to do the most rudimentary activity of conducting a campaign. It's completely untenable. And my hope is over the next 4.5 weeks is what we have left, assuming the Ohio shenanigans doesn't cut it off at the pass. I suspect not. You know, that's been another amazing thing of the last few days, watching Nate Silver fighting with Harrison, the head of the DNC on Twitter, with them attacking each other and Harrison's attacking Silver, and Nate's like, why are you arguing with a blogger? Don't you have a job to do? You're running in a presidential campaign. What are you doing? So I think the only hope is, I think realistically, that the swirl, the number of elected officials, the number of high ranking elected officials, and these continuing attempts by Biden to actually make the case publicly and it failing leads to the equivalent of whipping the delegates, that basically, look, I know you're in that 30% who wants Biden still even now. But if you look at this realistically, you who are not ensconced in the White House surrounded by family, you can actually look at this empirically and realize we are nominating a man who cannot possibly defeat Donald Trump. And in fact, is queuing up a landslide victory for him, which is a catastrophe for him, but far more for the Democratic Party in the country, and hopefully prevail on that basis. But then, and I'll stop now, but then we're left with the convention of all conventions. It's not even like the old days where at least you had a sense of who the front runners are. Like we have a convention now where the sitting president has been deposed. And we have the vice president as a possibility and all these other people in the room and no sense of where it's going to coalesce. It's like the worst collective action problem in human history. I have no idea how it could possibly work out, but something's going to happen.
Okay. For what it's worth, I would beg to differ slightly with your suggestion that the delegates could be the ones to do this. I don't think that could happen just because of the nature of who the delegates are. But I do think it's possible that a concerted push by the leaders of the Democratic Party, not Barack Obama, because of the bad history there between him and Biden, and probably not Bill Clinton either because of the Hillary thing from 2016, but Nancy Pelosi and others, you know, going to him and saying you're not getting the right information. Here's the thing.
Well, Chuck Schumer
Schumer. I think they might be able to do it. I don't know. But if he doesn't step aside, then I think the party is going down with it. God only knows. All right. Let us turn now to our final segment of the week of this podcast. Before we do that, I just want to correct something I said earlier about Tucker Carlson saying that he works for RT. Apparently, I am informed he doesn't actually work for RT. They simply repeat and rebroadcast a lot of his stuff, which they've been doing for a long time. Especially when he was still on Fox, he said that he wanted Russia to win the war in Ukraine. He was behind Russia. He has been a toady of Putin's for a very long time, and I would cite the interview that he did with Putin a few months back. So anyway, that's Tucker. All right, let's turn now to our highlight or lowlight of the week, Linda Chavez.
Well, given what we saw this last week, I want to point to, it's a podcast, but what I did is not listen to the podcast. I'm not unfaithful to Beg to Differ. I don't listen to podcasts outside the Bulwark Network. But I did read the transcript, and that was from the Free Press, and it was called "Are We Living in Late Soviet America?" It was a debate between Neil Ferguson and Jonah Goldberg. Neil Ferguson, as his premier column in the Free Press, wrote that the United States is similar to late Soviet Union, sort of late stage, fall of communism. And he talked about all of the terrible things that are going on, the fentanyl crisis, the lowered death rates, the kind of demoralization, as he called it, of America. And his description of what's happening was sobering. And a lot of what he said is true. But comparing it to the Soviet Union was a bridge too far for me. And I think Kathy Young wrote a piece countering it. But I thought the debate with Jonah Goldberg was particularly good. And I do think that it's worth thinking about, because I think what we are seeing in terms of what's happened to the Republican Party, even the attempt on Donald Trump's life and all of the talk of civil war that's been going on the right over the last few years should be sobering, and we should be thinking about it. And I think this is an interesting and smart debate.
Thank you for that. I would just insert an editorial comment, which is that Neil Ferguson's piece comparing the U.S. to the late Soviet Union was the dumbest thing that a smart person has ever done? Just throwing that out there. Andrew Egger.
Yeah, I guess also, you know, with the obvious stipulation that the real low light was the assassination attempt. But just to, you know, keep things actually interesting and not just say that. I don't want to, you know, spend too much time dunking on Damon. You brought up the Biden's remarks yesterday at the NAACP, where he actually was okay for a big lot of it. He seemed more energetic. The crowd was into him and all that stuff. So it was kind of like a good day for him overall. But when he was talking specifically about the rent control proposal, the way that he brought that up, and I'll just read what he said. He said, the idea that corporate owned housing is able to raise your rent $300-$400 a month or something, I'm about to announce they can't raise it more than, and then he kind of paused and he like kind of like squinted and leaned in. And then he said $55, which is remarkable. I mean, the one sentence version of the policy that he is proposing is that landlords will not be able to raise rent more than 5% in a year, right? That's a simple concept. It's easy to understand. And it was written out right there for him on his prompter. It's not like a verbal issue. It's not even like a visual issue, right? I mean, it's his proposal. He's like, oh, there's the prompter telling me about my proposal. Now I will say to you what that is. But he appears to have been thrown for a loop by the number 5 and then a percent sign. He was like, what could that mean? $55 maybe. And then he just went on. I mean, it was the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. I mean, even in all of this stuff, even from the debate and even in all of his kind of abortive attempts to clean up after that debate. I mean, that was the first time that I really kind of was like, what's going on in his brain? You know, I mean, like that at such a basic level. And so for me, that was, I think, the low light of stuff I've seen this week.
Wow. Yes. Agreed. I mean, I have the quote that I won't go into it now, but which, you know, agree, you know, he had one really good line in the NAACP speech. He did say, you know, that he scored Trump for saying that, you know, black jobs were being taken by illegal immigrants. And he said, we know what a black job is, Vice President of the United States. So that was a good line. But then there were so many moments where it was total gibberish and where he just, and as Damon points out, he has now adopted this little tick where when he loses his train of thought or when he becomes inaudible or completely, you know, incoherent, he says, anyway, and he just moves on. It's just, it is unbelievable. Okay, Damon.
Well, I have a pair of lowlights, of course, conceding what Andrew said, that, you know, the attempted assassination of the Republican nominee was obviously the worst thing of the week. However, I can't resist this, really, but it has to do with reactions to that event. So a pair of items. First of all, a tweet from my favorite guy in the world, Saab Omari, on Twitter on that evening. He tweets this: I'll be honest, if a bullet grazed my ear, I would not have it in me to get up, pump my fist, and urge my supporters to fight. That's evidence of a truly extraordinary man, world historical in the way Napoleon was for the 19th century. This is, of course, a reference to the philosopher Hegel, who, you know, said that world spirit was riding on horseback in the form of Napoleon. So that's amusing. I looked at that and I just rolled my eyes like, okay, so Rob, that's what you do. Okay, so you're going to metamorphosize yet again into like a new kind of Trump supporter. But I have to say, everyone who listens to me on this and in other form know that I really like Ross Douthat. I like him personally. I like his columns. I respect him as a thinker. I often disagree with him productively in a way that I appreciate. However, I have to give him a bit of a ding this week because he either had the same thought or he read that tweet and said, that's such a great idea. I'm going to use my platform at the New York Times to expand on it. And he wrote an entire opinion column titled, I kid you not, Donald Trump, Man of Destiny. That went in and delved and elaborated on it. And he name checked the Hegel and I couldn't believe what I was reading here. And he's followed up, by the way, on Twitter over the last 24 hours with tweets with like polls, like which figure is more world historical? And it's like a poll with Trump, Clinton, Obama, and so
Unbelievable.
Forth.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I won't even waste people's time delving into why this is just ridiculous, not just because of Trump being who he is, but such speculation is always just a kind of exercise, sorry, in mental masturbation. This is just not a serious intellectual exercise to talk this way. This is like a This is frankly, I have to say about Douthat, who's been, I think, consistently anti-Trump while perhaps not being sufficiently anti-Trump at times. But it sounds like someone trying to talk himself into something. I'll leave it at that. And to see at this late date him go in for that is really demoralizing. Like, is there going to be anybody left on the right who can just say, no, Donald Trump just stinks. He's not a man of destiny. He's not special. He's not world spirit incarnate. He's just Donald Trump.
Thank you for that. I would just point out that Napoleon was defeated. So spent the last years of his life on St. Helena. But all right, I want to draw attention to a piece written by my friend David Frum the day after, I think, the attempted assassination of Trump, in which he really, like, right on the news, he was able to make all the points that needed making. You know, that he said, look, nobody, he said, talking about this whole tendency to say, let's lower the temperature and blah, blah, blah. He says, nobody seems to have the language to say we abhor, reject, repudiate, and punish all political violence, even as we maintain that Trump remains himself a promoter of such violence, a subverter of American institutions, and the very opposite of everything decent and patriotic in American life. All American people welcome the sparing of his life. Trump's reckoning should be with the orderly process of law, not with the bloodshed he rejoiced in when it befell others. And that is sort of the précis and the most important lesson to draw from all of this. And, you know, let's remember Trump mocked mocked Paul Pelosi when he was attacked by a truly political would-be assassin. And when he, you know, he had his head, his skull cracked by this guy, and Trump and all of his vile sons spread the rumor that it was a homosexual tryst gone wrong, etc. So anyway, it's important to keep that in mind. All right. With that, I want to thank our guest, Susan Glasser, and our fill-in guest, Andrew Egger, this week. Thanks for joining us. And of course, my regulars and our producer, Jim Swift. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.